Yarika, feeling sorry for Danny and smiling at him, indicates the small spear over where he slept. He can't deny he has grown very fond of the boy in this short time. You can have that one. You're a smart boy. You'll work out how to throw it. But never at your brothers. This is Yarika's attempt at lightening the moment. Danny knows Yarika must go. The logs have been cut and brought to the front of the house, ready to split and stack. And with the full moon tonight, he will be gone. Danny can't hide how he feels. He doesn't want Yarika to go. I wish I could tell him how I feel. That he means something to me. More than me own da, if I'm honest. A friend to trust and to share my secrets with. He's my burden. And he'll know what to do. He'll make it right. And then Ma will be safe, and Joe Jr. and Henry James can play on the wood heap as much as they like. I haven't felt this safe at home in a long, long time. It'll be sad to have that feeling go. And it'll be gone when Yarika leaves. Yarika sees Danny's little face distort with mixed thoughts and emotions. He places a hand gently on Danny's shoulder and gives it a little squeeze. I've enjoyed our time together, Danny. This was special for me. You're a good boy, young man. You look after your ma. She's a good woman. And remember what I taught you. Danny avoids looking up at Yarika. His emotions are raw. The moment is broken by the voice of Molly coming from the door of the shanty. She calls to her son. Danny turns to go, but stops short, rubs at his nose with the back of his sleeve and sniffles, drawing up his snot. He's been trying desperately to hide his emotions. He turns back, throwing himself into a big hug with Yarika. Moved, the man receives the boy as if he were his own, holding him tight, patting him affectionately on the back, and then pushing him towards his mother. But Danny resists. Bringing his hand up to shield his mouth, he whispers into Yarika's ear. Bewildered, Yarika pushes Danny back at arm's length. From where Molly is watching, she's a little concerned. She sees Yarika not understanding. He mouths the words, "What did you say?" Molly calls to Danny again, tersely this time. He hears his ma's tone and goes directly to her. As Danny runs back to his mother, he considers what he just said to Yarika and questions his judgment on sharing it. But if he's to go by the look on Yarika's face, it's clear the black man has not understood what he said anyway. Or has he? Mother and son head inside, Danny throwing a quick glance back to Yarika, who stands looking baffled at what he's just heard and trying to make sense of it. Chapter 21. The Clintoffs' property is a quaint early Victorian-style two-bedroom house. Formal in appearance, but plain. A pitched, hipped roof of shingles. A veranda out front and down one side that has been closed in. Ornamentation restrained. An off-white picket fence, the finishing touch. The property sits just off the main thoroughfare to Everton. The open plain country makes the house easy to see and access effortless. There is smoke rising from the chimney. A blanket of frost covers the front lawn. Nate sits on the side of the bed looking pretty worn down. Last night was rough and long. Bruises are forming on his upper body from the fights and scraps he's had over the last 24 hours. After he lost out to the thieving swagman, he went toe-to-toe, hit-for-hit, with a few drunken stockmen. He was incredibly grateful for their inebriated state. Then he walked the slight incline to the jailhouse so many times he lost count, with more drunk stockmen. And a few gentlemen too. It was a huge effort to get them up the hill and hurl them into the cells. This morning he feels every strained muscle he used in surviving yesterday's mayhem and lawlessness. He struggles to put on his boot. He hears Louisa in the kitchen clanging pots and pans as she prepares breakfast. She sneezes. Nate calls to her. Bless you. Thank you. You should see a doctor. You don't feel any better, Louisa? I'm fine, she says, just as a huge coughing and sneezing fit comes on. Louisa? Oh, dear me. She sniffles and wipes at her nose. Seriously, I'm fine. I'm more concerned for Mrs. Johnson and wonder about her birth and what she's had. A new baby. Wouldn't it be wonderful, Nate? Nate looks up to find her standing in the bedroom doorway. Nate? Finally, his boot slips on. A baby to goo and gar over? Nate strides over to Louisa and takes her in his arms, pressing her close to his bare chest. Louisa, loving his scent, breathes him in, nuzzling his neck and kissing the bruises on his chest and shoulders. His upper torso is defined by muscle, compensation for his lame leg. She places her hands gently on his chest, knowing how to get her way, and slowly moves them up around his neck, leading him to her lips. A gentle kiss. Her glazed eyes connect with his. Do you really have to go in so early? Why, Mrs. Klintoff, are you trying to seduce me with your son still asleep in his cot? Nate looks back to little sleeping Samuel. That's a little unusual. He's normally up, running around, causing chaos. He had a restless sleep. His nose was a little blocked. But don't you go changing the subject. Call it what you want. I want a baby, Nate. She pulls his face to hers, devouring his mouth. He responds passionately, but after a few lustful moments pulls away and holds her at arm's length. Not now, sweetheart. I have to collate details and release 20 men this morning. I have to find a murderer and... Playfully, he continues on. How irresponsible of you to kiss me so lustfully with you having a cold. He pats her on the bottom as he pushes past her to the kitchen table. My plate's still empty, woman, he jokes. Louisa can't help but smile at his playfulness. She knows she will pick up this moment again, this evening, perhaps. She watches Nate at the table putting on his shirt. What a fine specimen of a man she has. After another fit of coughing, her voice strained now from the burning she feels in the back of her throat, she tells Nate she would love to go out and see Molly and the baby. How thoughtless of me! We should have offered to take her children back. Louisa thinks it's a grand idea, smiling to herself as she turns her perfectly fried eggs. Oh, I hope she's okay out there. Nate considers it. It's not a bad thought. Louisa goes about preparing his plate, but he's hoping that Joe Johnson has had his fill of drinking, fighting, and fucking and has headed home. Nate didn't lock him up last night with the two others from his team, so he's hoping he's already back with his family. Louisa breaks her husband's thoughts. Any advancement in the murder case? She places his plate of bacon and eggs in front of him. With a resigned tone, he replies, We have troopers coming from the north and south. They should arrive in a day or two. Then we'll head back out to the Edwards property for a thorough search. But to be honest, I don't know where to begin. He shakes out his napkin, places it across his lap, and begins to eat. Louisa returns to the sizzling bacon, just as a stagecoach leaving Everton races past. The rattling of the undercarriage and the thundering hooves of the horses cause her to look up. She glances out the little window above her stove, and there, on the main thoroughfare, she notices a shifty-looking swagman. Unbeknown to her, it's the same thieving sundowner her husband chased and lost last night. Thomas McNeely. He's heading out of town, a bottle of liquor under his arm, reciting to himself something of grandeur and waving his hands. Poor senile man, Louisa thinks, but only for a second. A cold shiver runs through her. Nate asks, Have you been all right here by yourself? I worry about you and Samuel. In the dust of the passing stagecoach, the swagman shuffles along. Just before turning back to answer her husband, Louisa sees the sundowner leave the track and head into a small section of thick scrub not far from their home. Her breath catches in her throat. Yes, fine, thank you. She doesn't want to bother Nate. He has a lot to do already this morning. She surely doesn't need to worry about a harmless old swagman having a tipple in the peace and quiet of the scrub. Thank you for this. Nate slops a piece of bacon in the runny yolk of his egg. Just what I needed. I don't think I ate much yesterday. Can you fix Trooper Leslie a plate? He's been there all night. Louisa is happy for the distraction and glad to help. She grabs another plate and fills it. Can you come home for lunch today? She asks, looking towards the scrub where the swagman disappeared. Nate immediately looks up, egg falling from his fork, concern clear on his face. Of course. Louisa hears his concern. Samuel would love to spend some time with his papa. What time? Nate goes back to eating. Louisa does the maths as she wraps up the breakfast for Trooper Leslie. Say, 1 o'clock? 1 it is. Nate pushes his empty plate away. Before you go, I need to show you something. She skips past him, coughing as she goes to her work desk in the far corner of the living room. Is this another attempt at stalling me? He teasingly asks. On the desk sits a mimeograph and wax paper, the departing gift from her father. Beside it is a stack of printed papers. She grabs one from the pile and presents it to Nate. Well, 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 he looks over the paper. So proud of you, sweetheart. Pleased with herself, Louisa smiles, sniffling into her handkerchief. First published female writer of Everton, which, by the way, is named after Evelyn Edwards. How's that for local trivia? She manages, proudly standing before her husband like a schoolgirl handing in an assignment. He smiles affectionately at her and says, Founding family, arrived 1820s. Top that. Louisa takes a seat on his lap, draping her arms around his neck. Folklore has it that Charles Edward fathered a black child, the whitest something around. Dubiously, Nate looks at his wife questioningly. What? She asks sheepishly. Raising an eyebrow, he says, May one ask, how did you come by this information, and under what guise did this conversation take place? Nonchalantly, with a nervous, cheeky grin, she says, Miss Shirley called it history. A deep, sexy chuckle escapes Nate, and he goes back to peruse the paper, then reads from it. Battered wives, is it purely a husband's right? Serious topic to introduce yourself with? Louisa stiffens on Nate's lap, saying, My sister remained silent and met her death, Nate. City life, bush, or mountain country, we must give the subject of violence towards women a voice. It needs to be legislated. He gently takes her beautiful face in his hands, entirely in love with her, in awe of her, and grateful for her strength and determination. Nate kisses his wife deeply, and she passionately submits, feeling safe and loved in his strong arms that wrap tightly around her, and he in hers. A plate of partially eaten bacon and eggs sits to one side of the desk as Trooper Leslie scribbles frantically with his dip pen on a piece of paper. It reads, Arrest, drunk and disorderly. On his other side, a pile of arrest papers mounts. The jail was absolutely at capacity the previous night. Robert Parson, the stockman from the Boxing Ten fight. The stockman Nate kept a close eye on due to his connection with Joe Johnson, approaches the trooper's desk. He indicates the stack of arrest papers and says, This is a first. John McFarlane, his boy's sidekick, pulls at a loose rotten tooth and joins him. He hands Parson his oilskin. These two are regulars in the lockup at sale time. There is something in their eyes that can't be trusted. They weren't hardworking stockmen. They would more than likely be ruthless outlaws, Nate thinks. It's what Spencer Leslie said when they were locking them up last night. They were so drunk that they couldn't have hurt anyone. But spinning the barrel of a gun and holding it to your head to prove loyalty wasn't the best idea to show their comradeship. Locking them up was for their own safety. Nate stands at the utility cupboard getting their pistols and shotgun. He removes their name tags from the weapons and hands them back. Nate answers Parsons' question. Just a precaution. Need to record offenders, a way to track crime, suspects. McFarlane leans into Nate's face, far too close, his breath revolting.
The fucking murderer is one of them fucking savage black niggers? No decent fucking white man could murder an upstanding white woman and her children.
Nate doesn't flinch, although his stomach turns from the stench of McFarlane's breath. Thank you for your opinion, Mr. McFarlane. Duly noted. Nate steps away to the other side of the desk. Parson has filled in the forms with no fixed address on both. Nate studies them as McFarlane signs his name with an X.
He's left-handed, Nate notes.
Joe Johnson head home? Nate casually asks. The stockmen look at each other, dumbfounded.
Was he in town? Asks Parson. His horse was in the yard, I'm assuming.
Parson cuts in.
No, we found his horse running with some Brumbies. We're heading out there later today. See if our old mate's all right. First time in 8 years he's missed the drove.
Nate is perplexed. This revelation completely contradicts what Molly said. He continues with his questioning.
You sit up in the mountains with the sheep for, what, 3 months?
Parson and McFarlane nod.
And Joe Johnson was not with you.
They both nod again. Cocky McFarlane can't help himself.
First time in 8 years. You hear him, yeah?
Nate's beginning to dislike this man boy. The two stockmen leave. Spencer has watched the exchange and sees the quizzical look on Nate's face.
Sir?
That just contradicts everything she said.
Beg your pardon, sir?
Nate contemplates, remembering Molly's words.
My Joe's a drover. Been away 3 months now. My Joe brings all the supplies home.
Then Nate remembers her talking to her eldest son about bringing supplies home. She gave him a list.
What is going on?
Why would she lie about her husband's whereabouts? Nate's concern has shifted slightly. He's still worried for Molly's safety and the safety of her brood. There's still a murderer on the loose in the district, after all. But what he has just discovered has triggered something else in him. Maybe he does have to get out to the Johnson property, because maybe her Joe isn't coming home. Maybe he upped and left her. She will need protection. A woman on her own, with children, in the high country. Baffled, Nate sighs in exasperation as he considers all of this.
Sir?
Inquires Spencer again.
Who contradicted themselves?
Molly Johnson.
Chapter 22. Molly wipes the sweat from her brow and places a hand on her lower back as she stands upright and stretches out. Under the front awning of her veranda, the new wood pile is almost complete. She stacks the heap while Yadika splits the logs. Only a few remain. His work here is almost done. Yadika brings down the sharp axe and splits the piece of wood in two. He throws them gently at Molly's feet, and she bends to scoop them up and pile them onto the wood heap. Yadika takes her in as he works, this hard-working, healthy, handsome, nurturing woman. He can't help but admire her. He's only been staying at her property a short time, but there is something about Mrs. Joe Johnson that has him genuinely intrigued. Yadika says,
"This big wind picked up."
Molly looks at him, taking in her surroundings as if looking for the wind. "All around, but never touching me." She realizes it's the beginning of a story and gives her attention to him. She enjoys a yarn and appreciates the pause in the back-breaking job at hand.
"Straight up."
He moves his hands, mimicking a whirlwind.
"No good, see? Ran all the way home then. That's when I found them. My woman, dead."
She was beautiful.
Yarika gets caught in the memory and stops what he is doing to fully appreciate his vision of his wife. Black shine and skin in full moonlight. It's as if she stands before him. Maybe in his mind's eye she does. Molly is taken aback by the openness and beauty of Yarika's speech and, maybe, him for the first time. This gentle, kind, caring, handsome man. Molly becomes awkward, feeling as if she is intruding on a private, personal moment. And when she danced, smooth like shallow running water over river rocks. Molly clears her throat, slightly uncomfortable with the intimacy of what he's just shared. Yarika is a little embarrassed to have revealed so much of himself. He hasn't felt safe, ever, to share that story with anyone until now. Maybe he should tell her, all of it, everything. Yet what good would it do? He's leaving tonight, going home. But what's there? He's been away for almost 23 years, and if the development in the north is anything like the development in the south, does he even have a home or family or a way of life to go to? Molly sees his concern and he turns to her saying, I found my wife and my children, all the old people, dead, slaughtered. A moment of silence passes. Reading the tracks left behind, I could tell my family were forced into the river, the water slowing them. Emotion catches in his throat. They were fired upon from both banks. An ambush. Calculated and planned. Murder. Molly nods in acknowledgement. She knows of the brutality and callous law towards the blacks and has no words. Yarika shakes the memory from his mind. They look at each other again, and for the first time they connect on another level, sharing in the grief of losing loved ones, children. Molly is deeply touched and finally manages to say, I'm so sorry to hear your loss. Yarika manages a little nod of appreciation. He can't look at her, deeply moved by her sincere reaction to his pain. He busies himself with the task at hand. Yarika grabs another log and splits it in half. But he can't help but continue. This releasing of his story feels right.
The tribe put me out. I wouldn't go with them for payback.
He splits one half again. Molly sees his hurt. No amount of time could ever heal such a trauma.
I knew nothing would come of it. Too many whites, too many guns now.
He splits the other half and tosses the four pieces at Molly's feet. Only the sound of nature and the caw of a distant crow can be heard, filling the silence between them. Yarika turns in the direction of the caw and pays his respects with a nod.
Why do you do that?
What? Acknowledge the caw of the crow.
That's my mother's, mother's, mother's totem and the carrier of souls to the dreaming. The crow has a special place in my clan's creation story.
Molly is intrigued.
I'm just paying my respects either way,
Yarika adds.
Thanks for sharing that,
Molly says, as she gathers up the pieces of wood and goes back to her stacking. Time to put her emotions in line.
I'd have to be made of river rock not to be moved by his story. To lose your wife, that's one thing. But your whole family? Three babies? At the hands of callous men in their charge for progress? I shake my head at the vision conjured there. I've seen this aggression with my own eyes. You could only have pure hate to be driven to such an act, surely. But I heard my dad talking about the encounters with the brag and men of entitlement who rained down terror on those blacks. When I think back now,
Once the whiskey was finished, the fights Madar got into were with those very same men. Maybe that explains his soft spot for the Aboriginal woman who sometimes visited. I would have put myself in front of one of those murderous bullets that decimated his family. To witness such a thing. I wouldn't have had the strength to continue. His resilience is to be honoured. I wonder if this is what happened to the djinn who helped with my dar in his death and the birth of my three sons. It's been a long time since I saw her.
Molly turns back to see Yadika standing at the water barrel. He drinks. He removes his shirt, dips a rag into the wash bucket and freshens himself up, wiping his face, then his chest.
And for some godforsaken reason, I'm drawn to this man.
Molly's breath catches. She has never felt this way before. New feelings, tingling sensations, ripple through her body, in parts she has never felt, and she feels shock and pleasure that you could get these sort of sensations there. She bites down hard on the inside of her mouth to snap out of whatever this ridiculousness is. She is desperately trying to find some common sense in all of these overwhelming feelings.
There's not so much difference between us, perhaps. Grief we share. Loss and grief. Love for our kin. His care and concern. His gentle way through the delivery of my stillborn baby girl. It all makes sense now. He ain't no heathen savage, that much I know. If any of them are. Damn it. This is what happens when you let people in. I can't show weakness. I can't let anyone in. Got too much at stake.
He senses Molly behind him, watching.
I'm heading home, following the Eastern Highlands, running north to my mother's country,
Yadika says, finally breaking the silence. Molly knows she can't get caught up in his life story. Her hard exterior returns, for her own sake more than his.
Why are you telling me this? A life story untold is a life not lived, missus.
Molly thinks on this a moment. He's right, and her dar would have thought the same. He looks at her suggestively, hoping she might open up and share more of her story with him. But Molly knows she must hold strong, and her sternness quickly returns.
You mentioned you're heading home?
Well, I'm not stopping you. She doesn't want to sound too rude, but she needs him to know she's not interested. She will not allow herself to be. The help he has offered is all she wants or needs from this man. This black man. Yadika pauses and looks at her as she goes about straightening the already perfectly stacked wood heap. He understands, but the silence is getting the better of them and they both know it. Yadika decides to break it before he loses her to the inside of the hut. Putting his shirt back on, he grabs the ladle and pours a scoop of water into a tin cup, taking it to Molly.
I saw the stone in your burial grounds marked Mary. That's your mother's grave.
Molly jumps on hearing him so close behind her. She quickly turns, but can't hide her flushed cheeks. She takes the water and drinks, praying the cool water will take the heat from her face. But in her mind's eye, all she sees is Yadika, this morning bringing the water up from the Murrumbidgee, his muscles straining under the weight of the full buckets on his fourth and final trip to fill the barrel. She felt privileged this morning, as that was her job normally, and the sight of him was pretty spectacular if she dare think on it.
Oh my goodness, stop this foolishness, woman.
Sorry, what did you ask? He can't help but smile and,
damn it, those perfect teeth. The rock in your burial grounds? Oh, yes. No. Something I just did. That's all my dad told me about her. Mama. Her name? Mary. Chipped it in there myself. Molly steps away, feeling very awkward now. She chides herself again at her behaviour and the ridiculous thoughts and feelings that are rushing through her. Was this what Miss Shirley warned her about when she had her first bleed and went to stay with her to learn of women's ways? Ah, dear. I couldn't imagine Miss Shirley feeling anything like this. Molly's own husband never sparked these feelings she's experiencing, let alone ask about the rock, Mary's rock, and he was the one who placed it in the family graveyard for her. Molly finishes the water, putting the cup back at the barrel, and clears her throat. Molly, pet name to Mary. As soon as she has said the words, she wishes she could take them back. Yarika catches his breath, shocked she's offered this piece of personal information. Choking on the inhalation, he coughs in amazement. She's told him something personal. Her name. Has he finally won her trust?
Kaligalba! Yes, all right, this is good. No white woman has ever given me her first name. I know never to ask for it or use it. And what a beautiful name it is.
Molly. Never thought I'd feel this again. Not after the death of my wife. And with a white woman. But there is something about this woman. Molly. I just can't put my finger on it. Or is it more that I'm so desperate and damaged and looking to see more than what is really happening here? I hope I don't show it. But I find Molly's strength, courage, determination and the love for her children so appealing and cannot help these deep urges. Is it out of convenience for us both that these feelings are surfacing and, or is this really happening? I wonder if she feels it too.
Not wanting the moment to end, Yarika starts to ask another question. But Molly cuts him off, indicating the now finished, stacked wood heap, sitting perfectly under the awning of her veranda for easy access and out of the elements, she says, "Thank you. Time to go."
No.
Thoughts race through Yarika's mind.
No, we have just begun. Stall, think, damn it, think.
Can I clean up, eat, and leave at dusk, missus?
That's your business. Just stay away from the house. You're done here. With that, she straightens up and heads inside. Yarika has to think fast to hold her attention. All he can come up with is,
"Thank you, missus."
She turns back to him and they finally lock eyes. She nods her appreciation.
"Travel safe,"
she says, and she means it. She heads inside, closing the front door behind her. Yarika hears the lock latching. He stands there, unable to hide his disappointment. He can't help but wonder,
what if?
He knows he must leave. It's for all their safety. There is nothing here with this white woman and her four white children. Not in their lifetime anyway. Even though he knows of a story of forbidden love between a black and a white, it was frowned upon on both sides. Life is hard enough. Chapter 23. At the other end of Everton, on the highest rise in the town, a modest-sized stone cottage and church sit side by side on a decent parcel of land. It is the McGuinness residence. An elderly Aboriginal man tends to the rose bushes that sit between the house and the church. He takes his time turning the soil at the base of each bush. Sergeant Clintoff walks past and the old Aborigine struggles to get up off the ground,
to appropriately address the man of authority in his presence. He finally manages to stand and nods respectfully, turning it into a formal bow. Nate smiles at the old man, uncomfortable with the formality of it all. The Aboriginal man lowers himself carefully back down, turning the soil methodically, his mind elsewhere as he smiles to himself. Tethered out the back is Danny's new purchase, the horse his ma instructed him to buy. Nate is impressed. Danny has a good eye. The mare is off-white, with a caramel-coloured mane and tail and big chocolate-drop eyes. She would have been a pretty little filly. Nate joins Danny, who is brushing her down.
Sorry to hear about your little baby sister. Miss Shirley just told me.
Danny continues without looking up.
Death's a part of life, sir. It happens.
Nate notes Danny's maturity. Indicating the horse, he says,
You think you'll get foals out of her?
Doubt it. She's too old. The man who sold her said her time for breeding is done. But she's strong, and we'll get some good years out of her yet.
Your da home yet, Danny?
The question jars Danny. He looks up at Nate, but then quickly busies himself again brushing the horse, walking around to the other side to avoid the question. Nate pushes further.
Sale's done now. He'd have the supplies, so I guess he'll be heading home then.
Danny stops what he is doing and, peering over the back of his horse, looks Nate straight in the eye.
Yes, sir.
Nate tries to see through the boy. Is he hiding something? Does he know anything? Nate strokes the bridge of the horse's nose and brings the conversation back to the animal that stands between them. He asks a few more questions. Its name, how many hands tall it is, what was the trade on it? Danny accommodates his questions, but never once looks at Nate. Danny continues brushing. Once finished, he checks the hooves for damage. They may need repairing. The poor animal will have to carry 4 children home tomorrow, a 4-hour trip with a heavy load. It's one of the reasons Danny got her. She was a pack horse and used to carrying weight over long distances. A big heart, the previous owner said. Danny works away patiently, detangling her tail.
You've done a fine job, Danny.
It's part of my chores at home. I groom and tend to Dar's horse before he leaves and after he comes back from a drove.
Nate thinks back to the state of Joe's mare that was left in the holding yard at the sale. She was in a very poor way and looked a lot worse for wear than the other working horses. Even though they are out on country working, a stockman will always brush down his horse once he finishes for the day. Nate has a few more questions about Danny's da, now that the boy seems to be comfortable with their conversation. He asks,
Did you see your da leave for the drove, Danny?
Still not looking at Nate, Danny's focus is on the last blasted knot of hair as he says,
No, sir.
Nate straightens up, alert to the fact that he might be onto something. Danny has seen this and pauses for dramatic effect. He's not silly. He knows what the sergeant is doing.
Long gone before we're up,
Danny adds, with a half-cocked eyebrow. Nate sees it and fires another question at him.
Your da ever been late to come home?
Danny gives one more final look over the horse, his ego leading the way now, thinking he's outsmarted the big city sergeant.
Sometimes he goes out on another drove or out to this place.
Danny stops himself, but it's too late. He's flapping his trap again. Suddenly anxious, he pretends to find something on the horse's hind leg. Nate knows he's got him. The boy does know something. Nate pushes a little more.
Where's this place?
Danny focuses on the mark on the horse's back leg, picking at it.
Danny, you ever been there?
Danny knows he said too much, and there's no way of turning his words around. Guilt is written all over his face as he says,
Please don't tell Ma. It was only the once.
The sun's high in the sky. not a cloud in sight on the wide open plains. At a crossroads, a dirt cloud rises from the track as a rider and horse belt along it. The horse comes to an abrupt stop, smack bang in the middle of the junction. It's Nate. He looks at his pocket watch. It's nearly 1 o'clock. And his lunch date promise to his wife weighs heavy on his mind. He looks off into the distance and sees their home, smoke streaming steadily from the chimney, knowing she will have cooked something special and his little boy will be anxiously awaiting his arrival. Nate's gut instinct has never let him down. It's how he survived the war with only a wound to his leg. In battle under heavy fire, he went back in to retrieve a fellow soldier. He hid himself behind a small shrub, weighing up his options. He was about to run in through the front door of a deserted building, but instinct told him to go around the back. And there he found his mate, heavily wounded. As he was dragging him to safety, Nate was shot by a sniper. He was lucky to escape with his life, the bullet shattering the bone in his upper left leg. If he had gone through the front door of the abandoned building, the sniper would have had a perfect chest shot and would have killed him before he even got to his mate, who survived as well, fully recovered and forever grateful to Nate for saving his life. Now, his instincts are telling him that something is going on with Molly Johnson. The lunch date with his wife and son will have to wait. Nate turns his horse and gallops off in the opposite direction. Nate pulls on the reins, slowing his horse to a trot. The land here is drier and less grassy, more of a red clay earth, harsher, further away from the river system. Slowing to a walk, the horse carefully steps through some scrub as they near a small hut. It lies just off the thoroughfare, about a half an hour from town. The hut sits right on the edge where the plain country stops and the scrub begins. A little privacy for Alpita Sava's business. Prostitution. Been in the area for some time now. Her father came here for the gold rush, but was killed in a dispute over ownership of one of the biggest halls. His wife and eldest daughter, Alpita, were left to fend for themselves and the two younger daughters. Alpita and her mother went into prostitution. They made a good living, supporting the two younger girls and giving them a good education away in Melbourne. Cautiously, Nate looks around. He approaches from the back of the hut. The madam of the house may have a customer and he doesn't want to barge in on anything. A robust woman, in her 50s at least, not at all pretty, stands in the doorway, her breasts on full display at the top of her corset. Her breasts are the best thing about her. Cigarette in hand, she exhales slowly, blowing a fine stream of smoke into the air. Nate is startled. He wasn't expecting her to be standing there, let alone bare-breasted. He doesn't know where to look. She smiles, pleasantly enough for a woman with no front teeth.
New sergeant, come to support local business. I'm flattered.
She hitches up her undergarment to cover her breasts. Nate tips his hat, a little embarrassed. Here to ask you a few questions, madam. With a cheeky grin, she asks,
before or after?
Nate's not sure how to respond, so decides to get straight to it.
When was the last time you saw Joe Johnson?
Her smile quickly falls away.
His wife, crazy bitch, came here waving a shotgun about. Must have been 3 months back now, or thereabouts. She walked in on us, placed her cows and dun on his balls and threatened to blow him off if he didn't get up that very instant and get home. Ranting and raving she was, about a bloody birthday ruined.
She mimics Molly screaming.
Fuck her all you want, but I asked you for the boy's sake. Something about her son's 12th birthday.
This has made things a little clearer. A domestic dispute. Could it have turned into something more? Something nasty? Or has Joe just up and left his crazed gun-wielding wife and the kids? Nate now knows he needs to get out to talk to Molly as soon as possible. But first, he must stop Danny and his siblings from leaving town. He just might be able to get something more from the boy. He tips his hat, turns his horse and gallops away.
Come back any time. First one's on me.
Elpida throws her head back, laughing huskily. Her laughter turns into a heavy smoker's cough, and she coughs up half a lung, spitting the bile onto the ground. Mountain life has sure hardened her. In a cell in the Everton jailhouse, Denny lies on a single iron frame stretcher bed. Joe Jr., Henry James, and Delphi play doctors and nurses, attending to their patient. They put their hands on Denny's chest. One puts an ear to his nose, another a hand on his forehead. They look at each other, shaking their heads. Then they hear Sergeant Klintoff calling from the front office area.
Denny, can you come here, please, son?
Denny lifts himself up onto his elbows and peers through the bars to the other side of the room, where Father McGinnis, Miss Shirley, and Nate stand, huddled around his desk. Their conversation is hushed, and he can't quite make out what they're saying. Now and then, they throw a look back at the children. Denny gets up slowly and heads out to them. Henry James is quick to take his place on the stretcher as Delphi starts the routine of hands to chest, ear to nose, hand to forehead. Diagnosis not good. Denny makes his way towards the desk. He's in no hurry. He knows he's in trouble. If not with these adults, he will be with his mother. He's said too much already. As he gets closer, his steps slow to a stop as he spots the poster of Yarika on the wall. It doesn't have the friendly eyes he knows the real Yarika to have. The eyes in the picture are fierce, enraged, and murderous. Miss Shirley breaks his focus.
Come now, Sergeant Klintoff is a busy man.
Nate hasn't missed a beat and looks where Danny is staring.
How do you know him, Danny?
Danny looks straight into the eyes of the curious Nate. The boy doesn't miss a beat either.
I don't, sir.
Nate has worked him out. When the boy lies, he looks Nate straight in the eye. When he is telling the truth, he looks away or down at the ground. Or he can't hide his guilt and gives himself away. That was the pattern when they were talking around the horse earlier. Nate gently pulls out a chair from the desk for Danny as he perches on the corner.
Come, have a seat.
The boy sits, desperately trying not to be drawn to the poster.
You've not long had a birthday. 12?
The question catches Danny by surprise. Nate watches him closely, reading his reaction. Danny's mind travels back to his birthday night. He is peeping through a crack in the wall, his eyes filled with fear. He hears a voice in the distance, gentle and caring. Danny? It's Nate, bringing him out of his memory. Danny looks down, fiddling with his fingers.
Yes, sir. About 3 months back.
Nate lets that sit for a moment. The room is still and suddenly, to Danny, airless. Beads of perspiration form on his top lip.
Can you tell me about your birthday night?
Danny can't hide his concern at how much Sergeant Klintoff seems to know. He locks eyes with the officer, taking a deep breath. Here comes the lie, Nate knows, but he'll play along with the boy.
They sang happy birthday. Us kids played a bit. Ma sat knitting, Da drinking. We went to bed and slept like logs, didn't hear a thing.
And there it is. Didn't hear a thing. Something did happen. Nate straightens up, trying not to appear too eager.
What things might you have heard on a night like this, Danny?
The boy can't hide it anymore. He looks off to nowhere as the memories come flooding back.
I lie in bed awake, scared. I can hear thumping coming from outside, and I flinch with each thud. Everything's muffled. Groans, moans, gasps, whimpers. And it's coming from my ma. There's a crack in the wall by the door.
so I creep out of bed to see for myself. My da towers over Ma, who's curled up on the ground trying to protect herself as he lays into her. Punch after punch. She doesn't cry out, probably for fear of waking the little ones. I'm frozen. Don't know what to do. Once before I came to Ma's rescue, Da slung me so hard I hit my head and was sick for days. Ma swore she'd never let that happen again, and I know that's why she's not making a sound. Taking the blows with as little fuss as possible, not wanting to draw me in. But I wish it was me he was beating. Not her. Please, not her.
Danny is rattled by the memory, but does his darndest to fight his emotions. He fiddles with his fingers, pretending to pick at some loose skin on a nail.
The usual, sir?
And what's that? Nate gently asks. Danny takes a moment, getting his emotions under control. The boy slowly lifts his head to bring his eyes to meet Nate's.
Wild dogs barking in the hills, crickets, distant owl, alligator dreaming, he whines in his sleep. And Da, well, when he's drunk he,
Yes, Danny, Nate says, leaning forward. Denny's eyes haven't moved off Nate's.
Farts a lot, sir.
From the cell the other children giggle. Nate knows Danny is lying, but he smiles, humouring the boy.
I only want to help your ma, Danny.
At this, Danny appraises Nate. Maybe he is a good man. Maybe Danny should tell him everything he knows about that night. But he promised himself he wouldn't. He never would. Not even to his own ma. Nate turns back to the McGinnises, who are annoyed at what they see as the boy's arrogance. He glimpses the poster of the wanted man and tries another angle.
He's wanted for a very brutal murder, Danny. 8 people he killed, a mother and her children.
Danny snaps a look at Nate. He won't believe it. That's not the man he knows Yarika to be. From the boy's disappointed reaction, Nate realises Danny knows a whole lot more than he's saying. Nate needs to get out to Molly Johnson's.
Over the range from your place. I'm worried about your mother. I'm thinking I'll take a ride out there myself.
He leaves a pause for Danny's benefit.
Talk to your mother. Look around.
Danny becomes a little anxious.
Look around.
There's great concern in his eyes now, but he holds his tongue, totally confused about his feelings and what he knows to be the truth about Yarika. But he is worried about his ma after learning this from Sergeant Klintoff. He can only hope she is all right and trust his instincts regarding Yarika's character. He looks back at the poster, and deep in his heart he knows Yarika is not a bad man. He knows what bad men do, and Yarika is nothing like his father. But Danny surprises them as well as himself with his reply.
I think that would be a good idea, Sergeant Klintoff.
The three adults turn to him.
Why, Danny?
Asks Nate. Danny puts his head down and talks to the ground.
She's alone, and I worry for her when I'm away.
Nate notes this as truth. He turns to Miss Shirley and says,
Please take the children home and keep them safe. I'll return with their mother in the morning.
Danny goes to say something else, but Nate is already out the door. Danny has second thoughts. Maybe he shouldn't have said that. Not with the secrets, lies, and ghosts that hover just above the surface of his Mars land like the first mist of winter. It's just too much for Danny. He heads straight back into the cell to his brothers and sister, looking for solace and comfort disguised as the responsibility he feels to protect them. Danny gathers his siblings to him and in a hushed, gentle tone tells them of the plan. They will be heading back out to the McGinnises. Delphi looks quizzically at Danny and says,
And tomorrow,
we head home?
Denny can't answer. He himself is unsure. Worry and concern fill his eyes.
Denny?
She asks again. Nate races along the thoroughfare from town on horseback. Ahead of him is his property. He snaps the reins to drive his horse harder, fighting the urge to stop. As he draws nearer, he can't help himself and his eyes dart to the house. Then he pulls hard on the reins, stopping the horse immediately. He takes in his new home, the chimneys. There's no smoke.
That's unusual.
The kitchen stove is always burning. He turns the horse and gallops towards the yard. The horse clears the front fence and they race around to the back. Before it even stops, Nate slides off. He hits the ground running mid-stride and sprints inside, favouring his blasted leg. He rushes through the back door into the kitchen, breathing heavily, rubbing out the pain in his leg. The amount of horse riding he's been doing is certainly giving his injury a workout. All is quiet, too quiet. The fire in the kitchen stove is out. Nate's concern grows. He calls, containing his anxiety.
Louisa?
No answer.
Louisa? Samuel?
He runs into the bedroom. There on the bed are his wife and son, sound asleep. Relieved, Nate goes to them. Quietly and gently, he perches himself on the edge of the bed, careful not to wake them. He looks at them lovingly and strokes his wife's face. She stirs. His hand is drenched with sweat and he realizes she is sick with fever. She is extremely hot and sweating profusely. He grabs a wet washcloth from the bedside table and gently dabs at her forehead. Louisa rolls over, about to throw up.
Nate, bucket.
He grabs the bucket just in time and Louisa heaves into it. He rubs her back. She lifts her head, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand and says,
Samuel?
He's right here, Nate reassures her. But she quickly turns to the boy beside her and says,
Nate, check him, lift him.
Nate is more than a little alarmed by her concern. He lifts the boy and his son's body lies limp in his arms. Louisa screams,
Oh my God, Nate!
Her exertion almost causes her to faint. She turns and heaves again into the bucket, collapsing back onto her pillow. Nate has swung around to the other side of the bed and puts his ear to the boy's chest, then a finger to his nose. Lifting the boy's shirt, he sees that his son is struggling to breathe, his diaphragm barely expanding with the shallow intake of breath. Nate takes a moment to think, knowing he won't be going anywhere near Molly Johnson now. His boy and wife need urgent medical attention.
I'll collect Molly tomorrow. The children will stay put at the McGinnises, as instructed. Molly won't be going anywhere. She's expecting her children home soon. Or I could get Trooper Leslie to go out and bring her in.
His greatest concern right now is his little family's health. Louisa and Samuel are in desperate need. Nate quickly wraps Samuel in a blanket and says,
I'll get him to the doctor and come back for you. Don't fret, rest. Samuel will be fine. You will both be fine. I'll see to it.
With that, he leans across and kisses his wife's forehead.
I love you.
Then he hightails it out the back to his waiting horse.
Hurry, Nate, hurry.
Louisa only just manages to call out after him. She turns and heaves again into the bucket. Chapter 24. The full moon finally peaks over the mountaintops, illuminating the landscape. On her veranda, Molly stares straight ahead, lost for words. Yarika stands before her, dressed in her husband's pants, a shirt, and the vest she mended the night before around the fire pit. His hair is damp and combed back.
Is this all right?
He asks. Molly still can't speak.
Your husband.
seeing me in his clothes. A pair of boots and you could pass for a decent man, she manages. Yarika looks at his bare feet. She does have a point. Maybe Danny was right when he said a decent man has boots on his feet. In the attire Yarika now wears, that statement kind of rings true. Molly continues. You worked for me, and I paid you in clothes, his clothes, old clothes. That's what you say. It's the truth. Yarika nods and turns to leave. Wait. He turns back to face her, and seeing Molly in the moonlight, he sighs with desire. I'll wax your hair so it stays straight. The wet hair will dry. Your hair will curl. Sit. She indicates the chopping block. Yarika knows he should just go. Leave now. But his heart tells him to stay. He removes the axe and puts it to the side and sits. He stares out at the big silver moon rising over the mountaintop. Like a spotlight, it beams into the front yard. Molly has gone back inside to get the wax. She comes back with a small tin can in her hand, opens it, and takes out a dollop, working the wax between her fingertips. She looks to where Yarika is looking and hoarsely whispers, "Full moon. Good to walk by," he replies. Both know that this symbol marks Yarika leaving. She walks slowly towards him, taking in his form and massaging the wax into her hands. Her voice almost inaudible, she says, "Messes with a woman's mind." She steadies herself as she draws closer to him, steels herself as she reaches out and runs her fingers through his hair.